Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 25th of April, these are our main stories. The Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces agree to a 72-hour ceasefire from Tuesday. The US TV anchor Tucker Carlson parts company with Fox News days after it agreed to pay $800 million to settle a defamation claim. And
India's population is close to 1.4 billion, but the UN data has projected India to have a little more than 1.4 billion very soon.
Why India is about to surpass China to become the most populous nation in the world. Also in this podcast, China says it's going to use 3D printers to construct buildings on the moon. And Len Goodman, the popular judge on Strictly Come Dancing and Dancing with the Stars, has died, aged 78. We begin in Sudan, where a 72-hour ceasefire is meant to have started. It was agreed by the warring sides, the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF militia, after intense negotiations led by the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Our correspondent in Washington, Barbara Platt-Usher, told me how it came about.
The State Department and Mr. Blinken himself have been very actively involved in trying to get a cessation of hostilities. They worked hard to broker this temporary ceasefire over the Muslim holiday of Eid, and then they have been working to extend that, hoping to get something a bit more permanent. And so now, Mr. Blinken said, after 48 hours of intense negotiations, there had been agreed a three-day ceasefire. And he said during this period, the United States would work with all parties, international partners, as well as Sudanese civilians, to try and set up a committee that could negotiate a permanent ceasefire and implement that ceasefire, as well as deal with the humanitarian issues that have arisen out of the conflict, and of course with the goal ultimately of trying to return to that process of getting to a civilian government, which was upended by the two warring parties.
Why should this ceasefire stick when all the previous attempts have failed?
We haven't been told why. We just know that the Americans, as well as the regional partners, have been pushing very strongly for it. We haven't been told whether there was any punishment threatened. So, for example, whether the parties might have been told that their assets would be frozen. That has not been mentioned at all. It's really just a question always we're hearing of pressure for them to put down their arms. Now, Mr. Blinken has been in touch with Arab countries who have longstanding relations with one or both parties, urging them to use their leverage. He's also been in touch with African organizations that are trying to also bring a stop to the violence. So there has been a full court press from everyone who has any sort of stake in Sudan at all. And this is the outcome that Mr. Blinken negotiated. We'll see if it does any better than previous ceasefires, which have been shaky, to say the least.
Barbara Platt-Usher. Well, it's hoped that this lull in fighting will bring some temporary relief to the people in Sudan who've been desperately trying to flee the gunfire. Dr. Iman Abu Gaga is a British Sudanese doctor who was visiting her family in Khartoum when the violence erupted. With the help of the French embassy, she and her children have now been evacuated to Djibouti. But Iman had to leave her mother and sister and father behind. James Kumasami asked her how she felt about that.
Oh God, that's miserable. My dad, we went to say our goodbyes. He's very unwell. My granny is 96. My mum and sister and her son, they are all sheltering in my sister's house. It's a good thing we left because we were starting to run out of supplies anyway, in terms of water, in terms of food. So every mouth that is less to feed is more for these people.
You must, though, be worried about those you've left behind in Khartoum.
You know, I don't even want to think about it. I feel like I'm the worst human ever who walks away from their mother and father in a situation like this. It's just one of those things that I will never forget and I will never forgive myself. So,
well, you had the Hobson's choice, didn't you? Your children or your parents?
I was telling them, everyone was like, no, this is the right decision. No, that's a wrong decision. I was like, there are no right and wrongs here. They are all difficult decisions. Sudan is going to go into a spiral, and then we're going to start all over again with the problem of migrants crossing on boats. They're crossing because when this was happening, no one acted fast enough.
Can you just describe what you left behind and that journey to the French embassy and then to the airport and out? What did you see? What are the images that will stick with you?
The country is dirty. There's rubbish all over. There's sewage overflowing. It smells. So now we're next going to have an outbreak of illness and disease. And there won't be a hospital to go to. There won't be IV fluids to save people because they're dehydrated. There's RSF presence throughout the majority of Khartoum. I couldn't see much of the army. The entire country is blanketed in darkness. There is no electricity. It's what you make horror movies of. It's just unbelievable. And as we were driving along the Nile, I just kept looking and thinking, oh my goodness, I can imagine how beautiful this place could be. But here we are. We're just looking at death and destruction and destitution. This just cannot be the plight of this, the biggest country in Africa, that this just cannot be our destiny.
Hassan Ibrahim is a 91-year-old retired physician who managed to get on a bus and make the perilous journey north to Egypt, about 1,000 kilometres away. His words have been translated by a BBC producer.
We boarded one of those big buses that do these trips to Egypt. It took 12 hours until we got to the Argin border crossing on the Egyptian border. It was a long road with many potholes. It was a very, very long journey. The seating was uncomfortable. My legs were swollen and my blood was boiling. We arrived at the Argin crossing at midnight. We were searched and allowed to enter, and we went to the passport control. It was so crowded and chaotic. The hall was packed with people. Sudanese, complete families, elderly men and women, children, and all showing and pushing towards these two windows to hand over their passports for visas. There were around 3,000 people in two halls, and there were no seats, so people were stood on their feet or sitting on their bags or on the floor. We stayed there until 4 a.m. before leaving to get the crossing to get to Aswan. We had to wait for a couple more hours until the Egyptians checked our passports and counted us, because some were not allowed entry. There were so many families with elderly passengers, children and babies. The whole of Sudan is fleeing. The Sudanese are fleeing the country. It is a sad reality.
Hassan Ibrahim. The American channel Fox News has parted ways with one of its most popular and controversial presenters, Tucker Carlson. The right-wing broadcaster has left days after Fox News agreed to pay almost $800 million to settle a lawsuit with Dominion Voting Systems. Several of the channel's contributors, including Tucker Carlson, falsely suggested on air that Dominion's machines had switched votes from Donald Trump to Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election. Also, Fox News is facing a lawsuit by a former guest booker who accuses him and others of vile sexism. The channel denies this. Nomia Iqbal has more on Mr. Carlson's departure.
Well, I'm outside the headquarters of Fox in Washington, D.C. It's the primary location where much of Tucker Carlson's show was produced from and broadcast from. And one man walked past and he said, "What's going on? Is there some big story?" And we said Tucker Carlson's left Fox News, and he was shocked. And I mean, he did say he wasn't a fan of Tucker Carlson, but nonetheless, Tucker Carlson is, as you mentioned, there's such a controversial but very well-known presenter in this country. And I think for the 3 million people who watch his show every night for an hour, it's an opinion show, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern time, I think it probably is a shock. To others, probably maybe not as much, because this comes very quickly after Fox News settled that defamation case with Dominion, although we haven't been told what the exact reason is as to why Tucker Carlson and Fox News have departed with each other, because Tucker Carlson's show has been promoted this morning by Fox News and he signed off as normal on Fridays. But, you know, this is a man who is more than just a talk show host. He's a strongly influential figure with a huge following. There are millions and millions of Americans who watch him religiously.
Nomia Iqbal. Comments from the head of Russia's state-owned bank, VTB, have left some people wondering how healthy the country's economy actually is in the wake of the sanctions imposed over the war in Ukraine. Andrei Kostin said Russia now needed to get hold of private money and as much as it could, as our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhardt reports.
Russia's authorities often downplay the effect of Western sanctions, but it's clear they're having an impact. Andrei Kostin, an ally of President Putin, told state television that Russia needed to attract private investment. This, he said, could be done by part privatising some large state companies or their subsidiaries while holding on to a controlling stake. He cited firms like the oil pipeline company Transneft and Russian Railways. Mr. Kostin said such a process would be conducted differently to how privatisations were handled in the 1990s under Boris Yeltsin. Then, companies were snapped up at knockdown prices by politically well-connected businessmen, creating a class of oligarchs. Critics would question how much has really changed in the intervening period. It's not clear either where such investment would come from. The threat of sanctions will scare off foreign investors from many parts of the world. Mr. Kostin and his bank have themselves been targeted by Western sanctions. Earlier this month, VTB posted a record loss of $7.7 billion for last year. With relations between Russia and the West continuing to worsen, Mr. Kostin raised the prospect of temporarily taking over foreign-owned companies from countries deemed to be unfriendly. These, he suggested, could be run for the benefit of the state while sanctions against Russia lasted.
Danny Eberhardt. Now, if, and it's quite a big if, the United Nations has got its figures right, the world will have a new most populous nation by the end of this week. China, it seems, is being overtaken by India. Data from the two nations is uncertain, and it's possible India may already be more populous than China. Poonam Mutreja, executive director of the Population Foundation of India, told Rebecca Casby what India's population size is now and where it's projected to go.
India's population is close to 1.4 billion, but the UN data has projected India to have a little more than 1.4 billion very soon. And India's population has overtaken China, partly because Chinese population decreased. But the thing is that India's population is declining, but not at the rate China's population is declining, because we have a huge number of young people. We have 365 million people below the age 25, who are at a reproductive age. So India's population is going to continue to grow until the mid-century. What has happened in India is that the northern states have the lowest indicators for women in terms of literacy, education, and don't have well-governed health systems. They are the ones where the highest fertility takes place, and within those states, it is the poorest women.
Is the government responding to this? Do they see it as a problem that the country's population is growing this fast?
It is true that the country sees it as a problem. The country has overreacted often by asking for population control measures. There is so much conversation and knee-jerk response saying we have to do coercive measures. But at the same time, the bureaucracy in India has the data. India has great demographic data, and they have gone by that, and they have invested in family planning.
India does have a background of doing that in the 70s, don't they? Some really
yes.
controversial forced sterilization campaigns.
Absolutely. And that was a big setback to India's family planning program. And there is a perception that the government lost elections because of the coercion in family planning.
Is there a concern about the access to resources, though? Because you mentioned China, and we know that they've had issues with being able to secure enough food for their huge population. And in India, I know that in some parts, you know, access to drinking water is also an issue.
access to drinking water, schooling, education, health, all these are issues. But India had the opportunity to plan because we knew what our numbers would be. So you cannot use population as an excuse to not provide infrastructure and resources, which are improving in India. But the biggest issue is gender inequality. Women don't have the freedom to decide when they marry, how many children they have. That, I think, is the biggest challenge for India that India needs to work on. Because if women had more autonomy, the fertility would have been much lower, because unwanted fertility in India is 10%. And if you look at the numbers, that's huge.
Poonam Mudreja, the director of the Population Foundation of India. Still to come.
Shakespeare's plays do not survive in manuscript. So had they not gathered together those 36 plays, we could have lost 18 plays, including those great masterpieces.
The 400-year-old special collection of Shakespeare plays, which saved some of his best-known works from being lost forever. Thousands of migrants have begun a march across Mexico from Tapachula near the Guatemalan border to the capital, Mexico City. They're hoping that their more than 1,000-kilometre journey will put pressure on the United States to speed up their asylum requests and see Mexico close controversial migrant detention centres. Gareth Barlow spoke to Mimi Swaby, who's been following the story.
Many of these people have been in detention centres in Tapachula for months. And these centres are really overwhelmed by the sheer number of migrants moving through or attempting to move through Mexico to the States. Now, authorities are saying this mass of people is mainly Venezuelans, but there are about 3,000 migrants from China and other Asian countries too. Now, they're also demanding that there is an end to these migration centres after 40 detainees died last month in Ciudad Juarez in northern Mexico after a fire broke out, a real tragedy there, which has really brought into spotlight again this issue of migration centres.
And we've seen caravans crossing Mexico like this before, normally people on foot, sometimes entire families walking long distances. How long is it going to take them to make this journey? And what do they intend to do once they get to Mexico City?
It could take up to 10 days. And although thousands are walking together, mainly for safety, there are families, there are children, there are some really harrowing photos of children, many under six, taking this long walk. And the temperatures are really high as well. So it's a really hard and treacherous journey. I've seen people taking shelter under trees during noon, trying to wait for the temperatures to lower a little bit before they carry on. But obviously time is against them as well. They can't rest for too long. So if and when they do get to Mexico City, some will try and apply for refugee status, but they may struggle to obtain protection or any legal status because the policies are really aimed at preventing them from reaching the US. So this very treacherous, long and very hard journey could be in vain for many of them.
Mimi Swaby speaking to Gareth Barlow. China has announced plans to try to use 3D printing technology to construct buildings on the moon. State media said that during the future Chang'e 8 mission set for 2028, a robot will attempt to use lunar soil to make bricks. By 2030, China hopes that what it calls its taikonauts can live inside a lunar base built with these bricks. I heard more from the BBC's Bernadette Kehoe.
These are ambitious plans, and it's about creating a structure on the moon. And they point to China's long-term aim of lunar habitation. A scientist is quoted in the China Daily newspaper saying that if the country wishes to stay on the moon for a long time, it needs to set up stations by using the moon's own materials. So what it's planning to do with its Chang'e 8 mission, which is scheduled to take place in 5 years from now, is ultimately to have a robot attempt to use lunar soil to make bricks. The Chang'e 8 probe will conduct on-site investigations of the environment and mineral composition and also determine whether technologies such as 3D printing can be deployed on the lunar surface. And that's the process by which multidimensional objects are created using a 3D digital model.
So what's the background to China wanting to set up a structure on the moon's surface?
Well, back in 2020, China's Chang'e 5 probe brought back China's first lunar soil samples. And the subsequent Chang'e 6, 7 and 8 probes are all intended to prepare the way for a manned mission to the moon by 2030. And Chinese media reported earlier this month that the country wants to start building a lunar base using soil from the moon in 5 years. But it's not alone in trying to harness these new technologies to conquer the moon's surface. Last year, the American space agency NASA signed a $60 million contract with a tech company in Texas that's designing lasers to create building blocks from materials found on the moon, starting as early as 2026.
Yeah, and this all comes, of course, when there's a lot of competition to get people back to the moon half a century after the original moon landings.
Yes, the race to set foot on the moon has been intensifying. Beijing's competing directly with the United States in its moon mission plans. Back in 2019, when China successfully landed Chang'e 4, that was a small base station and rover, on the far side of the moon, it became the first nation to touch down in that uncharted side, never visible from Earth, prompting its chief designer to proclaim, "We're building China into a space giant." Beijing wants to land taikonauts on the moon by the end of the decade. But NASA's also stepping up the pace. It intends to return humans to the moon by next year and establish a permanent human presence that will allow astronauts to visit the moon on a regular basis. It says that with its Artemis program, it's building on more than 50 years of exploration experience to reignite America's passion for discovery.
Bernadette Kehoe. A 400-year-old rare collection of William Shakespeare's plays, which is believed to have saved some of his best works from being forgotten, is going on public display in London. Historians say that if the book hadn't been published in 1623 by two forward-thinking admirers of the English bard, around half of his works would have been lost forever. Our correspondent Louisa Pilbeam has been finding out more.
Macbeth, Twelfth Night, The Tempest, among the world's most famous and most admired works of literature. But if Shakespeare's friends, actors John Heming and Henry Condell, hadn't compiled what's known as the First Folio 7 years after the playwright's death, those masterpieces would have been lost. Now one of the finest examples of the volume has been displayed at London's Guildhall Library, where Dr. Peter Ross is principal librarian.
Before the First Folio, Shakespeare's plays were published in quarto, which is essentially a small single play, a bit like a paperback version of a play. And only 18 had been published before the First Folio. Shakespeare's plays do not survive in manuscript. So had they not gathered together those 36 plays, we could have lost 18 plays, including those great masterpieces.
The acclaimed film and stage actor Simon Callow said his eyes had filled with tears when he saw the book.
A miracle. It saved Shakespeare for the world, you know. It's an astounding thought that particularly those plays like Macbeth and so on, which are part of the language now, would not be there.
The Guildhall copy is one of the most pristine of the 230 in existence and one of the only complete versions. It will be displayed again for several months later in the year.
Louisa Pilbeam. Now, climbing 8,800 metres to the top of the highest and one of the most dangerous mountains in the world may not be everyone's cup of tea, but it certainly is for a lot of people, so much so that Nepal has now issued a record 454 permits for Mount Everest this spring season. And yet, 2 weeks ago, three Sherpas went missing after being swept into a crevasse only at the base of the mountain. So, what's going on? To find out, I spoke to our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
If you look at what happened in the past few years during COVID period, the mountain was closed for a while and they didn't allow many people to climb and they had to reissue those permits because of the COVID pandemic. And last year they started opening and I was there at the base camp. I could see a number of climbers. But then Because of the war in Ukraine, many people from Eastern Europe could not make it in the first round, even though the numbers started increasing. It went up to more than 300 climbers, I think. Now, people are traveling more, people have been training for this. And interestingly, what you see is a high number of Chinese. They have got 96 permits to climb. Again, China did not allow foreign climbers to go up Everest from their side because of COVID pandemic. Even this year also, they have not been allowed. So this is attracting more and more people because the communication is easier. Getting a permit to climb is also easier than going to China because China is just very difficult to get the permit now.
Is this a particularly dangerous climbing season?
Usually during spring season, it attracts mountaineers and climbers from all parts of the globe because it is a dream for many mountaineers to climb Everest. It is the most popular summit if you look at the other huge mountains around the world. And if you have enough training and if you have enough financial support and a good team, it is not like insurmountable a task to climb Mount Everest. And that's why it attracts hundreds of people from around the world. Of course, there are dangers. Hundreds of people have died while climbing Mount Everest. Even though it is dangerous, it still attracts that passion for mountaineering.
Expensive though, isn't it?
It is, because if you want to climb Mount Everest, then you need to get the permit, which is about $11,000 plus. Then you need to have a support team. A team of three or four people usually go with experienced groups or these mountaineering teams. You know, overcrowding also is a major issue here. If you're going to issue 454 permits, the window of opportunity of climbing the summit is very narrow. You will have like 3 days here, 2 days there. So then everyone will make a rush. And we saw this stunning picture of hundreds of people waiting in line to reach the summit. So how they're going to regulate the crowd, that became an issue a couple of years ago. Again, the Nepalese government will have to look into how they do this crowd control.
Anbarasan Etarajan. And finally, the world of ballroom dancing has lost one of its greatest names. Len Goodman, the former judge of the BBC's Strictly Come Dancing and the US version Dancing with the Stars, has died aged 78. His warmth, knowledge, generosity and wit made him an audience favourite on both sides of the Atlantic. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson looks back at his life.
It was like a cow pat on Country File, hot and steamy.
Len Goodman, the East End barrow boy who became one of British ballroom's best-known names.
What a load of bolognese, honestly.
He'd swapped fruit and veg for welding before, at the age of 19, a football injury would change the course of his life. A doctor suggested that as part of his rehabilitation, he should take up dancing. Within a decade, he'd won the British Championship and set up his own school. Then, at the age of 60, everything would change again when he was a last-minute replacement to be the head judge on the BBC's new Saturday night TV show, Strictly Come Dancing.
If it had happened when I was 30, I'd have been one of these people that would be seen rolling out of nightclubs drunk with a couple of dolly birds on my arms and all. It would have been awful, really. Things happen when they should happen, and I think that happened just right.
You floated across that floor like butter on a hot crumpet.
Len Goodman's ability to explain the technicalities of ballroom dancing while simultaneously being very funny was crucial to the show's success. Strictly co-host Claudia Winkleman particularly enjoyed his scoring.
He was an extraordinary man, a brilliant man. In my own house, we still never use the word seven. He changed a whole number for so many of us.
Seven! Seven! Seven!
Strictly's head judge also used to fly to Los Angeles and back each week to perform the same role on the US version of the show, Dancing with the Stars, only standing down last November after 29 series. On Desert Island Discs, Len Goodman was asked about having an almost 60-year career doing exactly what he loved.
I am one of the luckiest people on this earth.
That report by Colin Patterson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Balancing the needs of your business and your employees has never been more important. Do both with Concur Expense. Speed up your finance processes, ensure compliance, and pay your employees on time when you automate your expenses. And with a handy mobile app, your teams can work from anywhere while focusing on what matters most, the bottom line. Move your business forward with SAP Concur Solutions. Visit concur.com to learn more.
Just imagine if you could quiet the noise and journey to deep sleep. Relax, I got you. I'm Shamir Anderson. Escape with me to soothing soundscapes around the globe. We'll wait out a storm on the Ethiopian highlands and take in the waves on a secluded Brazilian beach. Sleep sound with me, Shamir Anderson, an Audible original. Available now on audible.ca.